according to his power that is at work within us.
Welcome to our fifth episode of season one. Today, our title is Improving Contractors' Safety Performance. I am your host, David Griffith, and my two guests have over 60 years of combined experience dealing with all aspects of contractor safety. Our guests today are Jerome Spear and Jeremy Lancaster. Welcome to the program. So I've read many articles that Jerome has published, and one concept is clear, and that concept is that preventing incidents and injuries is the best way to prevent a lawsuit. Jerome, what are you seeing out there? Are we still having incidents and lawsuits?
Well, absolutely, we are. I mean, our consulting business is, we estimate about 75% of what we do is on the forensic side. So these are after an incident happens, and we're hired by attorneys to evaluate the case and provide opinions on the causes of those cases. So you have different forms of liability. You have the civil lawsuits, and you have OSHA liabilities in forms of citations and fines from OSHA violations and penalties associated with that. And then in some cases, if it rises high enough, you can have criminal negligence as well. So, aside from that, we're not attorneys, and the topic of liability becomes somewhat of a complex topic. And what I see is philosophies that owners or host facilities or general contractors take would either be a hands-on approach or a hands-off approach. And there's a fine line as far as taking too much of an active role as far as a hands-on where you're actually directing the activities of the contractor or subcontractor. And that provides more liability on that host employer or the general contractor. On the opposite end of the spectrum, a lot of them take a completely hands-off approach or I like to call it after the incident occurs, they stick their head in the sand approach and you know, say we're not at fault. You know, our employees and that sort of thing. So you have different extremes, and I would say the proper approach, in my opinion, would be to make efforts to prevent an accident, and that's somewhere where you're not directing the employees, but you're also managing them effectively from start to finish.
Good. So there's a lot more room out there to improve the prevention of incidents and injuries. Jeremy, how has your experience taught you the value of today's topic of improving contractor safety performance?
Yeah, and first of all, Dave, thank you for hosting us today. We appreciate you helping facilitate the two J's through this and be able to talk about one of our many favorite subjects around safety. But, you know, I back to your question, I've got the unique experience of working as a contractor for owners for almost half of my career. And then I've also worked from an owner perspective in setting some of those expectations around contractors who work at facilities that I've worked in. And building off of what Jerome said around, you know, you're trying to find that middle ground where, you're right, Jerome, years ago there was a lot of hands-off, but due to incidents, and incidents are still happening in industry, that's making the case as to why do we need to talk about this. And because of a lot of those incidents, owners have gotten more proactive. And when I say proactive, what does that mean? Is a lot of it is just being, I think you used the word manage a minute ago, but leading in safety, being a leader, being an influence to contractors. And when you do that from an owner perspective, contractors are going to follow suit. They're the ones paying the bills, setting the expectations. So when you do that, you know, it'll go from, okay, here are minimum things that I need to do, and then move into more proactive to actually reduce risk and prevent incidents. And that's the ultimate goal of what we're talking about here. So, you know, my experiences and why, you know, I've had experiences from both sides, and that's what we want to do today is share as much of that as we can in a podcast form.
Yeah, let me just add on to that. And Jeremy's right that the owners have a lot more influence than the possibility of having an OSHA violation. You know, and a lot of times companies consider that, well, one, it's not certain that you're going to be cited by OSHA in the first place. And then others consider it a violation as a cost of doing business in a lot of cases as well. Something I wanted to also mention before we move on to some of these specific topics we're going to talk about is when an incident happens, the general contractor or host employer are likely or likely targets to be brought into a civil lawsuit. And the reason for that is if the employer provides workers' compensation coverage, then there's a exclusive remedy clause which prevents the employee from suing the employer, his employer, for a workplace injury. There's some exceptions to that, depending on the jurisdiction, but that's the main reason. So, but if they choose not to provide workers' compensation coverage, then that opens them up for a lawsuit for an employee injury or fatality. And we're involved in some of those types of cases as well, where it's against the employer because the employee sues the employer and the employer had chose to be what's called a non-subscriber, meaning that they're not providing workers' compensation coverage for their employees.
Good. So what I'm hearing is it makes a lot of sense to reduce risk, prevent incidents, therefore reducing liability risk. And it's just good basic business sense. And you'd like to help people on the front end rather than figuring out what happened on the other side of an injury or incident.
Absolutely. That's you know, in that's where more influence can be made is on the front side, the planning side, the design phase, and it's a lot more cost effective as well. So if you're in this business long enough, you realize when a fatality or a significant injury happens, multiple things go wrong. So when you attack it in the early stages of the project planning phase predominantly, then it's a lot more cost effective and it's just, you have a lot more influence.
Dave, one other reason, again, making the case for listeners is, you know, that because there's several camps out there. There's some that might be listening to this and just checking the box to validate, okay, we're already doing this. But when you think about the growth in the United States with all the major construction projects and you think of international, all the neat time we're in with the industries and new technologies and existing energy producers are going to still be there. And then the new ways of a lot of energy and batteries and all the new construction that's happening, that creates more jobs. And those, what kind of jobs are those initially? Those are construction and contractors. So if you're listening and you don't have a good grip on this now, we'll share a few takeaways with you today that they're going to help you.
Excellent. So on this topic of improving contractor safety performance, I like what Jerome has to say about being proactive. Jeremy, I like what you put it in the phrase of leadership. You're leading toward better outcomes. And so we're going to approach the topic in five parts. The first is pre-qualification and selection of contractors. The second would be safety and health contract requirements. The third would be work in progress assessment and assurances. Fourth is the owner and general contractor expectations. And then fifth is performance evaluations and feedback. So let's dive in. Our first area is pre-qualification and selection of contractors. You know, what are some of the minimum requirements to approach this?
First of all, when I first developed these series of articles on this, it was years ago, and Jeremy was working with Chevron Phillips at the time, or Phillips, and you were over the contract.
That's correct. I was in a contractor safety coordinator role. I did that both with Phillips, Chevron Phillips, and CB&I before working in contractor safety.
So I was doing a project for a large pharmaceutical company doing a construction gap analysis. And where there's no specific standards on how to manage contractors per se. So my approach was to do a scientific literature review and do site assessments, and look at their management, existing management programs, and identify the gaps and provide recommendations. And this is what came out of it, actually a much longer detailed article or paper. But essentially, and we're not just talking about safety, we're talking about contractor performance in general. So it's careful not to, it takes a multi-discipline team approach and not just, it's not a safety function purely. Safety should be involved in the pre-qualification and contractor selection, but establishing criteria, and we'll talk about some typical safety criteria that's typical of owners or host employers that they've established. To even be on the bidders list, you have to, these are the minimum requirements. You know, the EMR, which is the experience modification rate, which is an insurance multiplier, if you will, an average for your industry is 1. So if you have an EMR greater than 1, means you're going to be paying higher premiums than your competitors, essentially. If it's less than 1, then you have a better safety record. You have, meaning that you have fewer losses compared to premiums. Okay. And so that's one metric. Now, if somebody has a lot of losses, a contractor has a lot of losses, and you know, there's nothing that prevents them from closing shop and starting a new business in a different name. You know, and they'll automatically assign an EMR of 1, or it's underrated. But you know, the other aspect is what is their track record in forms of their OSHA incident rates? Whether it be a total recordable incident rate or a lost time incident rate, things of that nature. Any fatalities or hospitalizations that occurred within the past 3 years. And typically, the statistics are asked for within the past 3 years. It may go within the past 5 years, but typically what I've seen is contract or host employers are asking for a history of the past 3 years. So some of the things that I recall that are the most common ones as far as the trailing metrics that people look for. Now there's some more leading indicators like their safety programs that they have in place.
Yeah, and some of those might even fit into when we start talking about some of the safety and health requirements. But to Jerome's point, and Dave, when I reflect on filling out the pre-qualification forms, I think, you know, in some of these, I'm thinking back 20, 25 years of, it's a bunch of questions. There's a lot of criteria, and they really are just that. And I've actually gone back and forth over the years of, okay, how effective are pre-qualifications? But they are effective because they are determining what are the minimum requirements that a contractor needs to have, what's minimally acceptable, whether it's the insurance requirements, whether it's the safety incident rates. So it's a lot of questions, but it's helping establish, and it's that first snapshot of, does this company have the right culture and focus on safety and associated risk management systems? So that's what pre-qualification is. It's evolved like everything in the world of digital, from filling out some handwritten paper forms. There's a lot of web-based subscribers that you can use across the United States that Jerome and I are familiar with. That's somewhat of a clearinghouse where you can subscribe, and the Houston Business Roundtable, as an example, and the Health and Safety Council in the Houston area have a contractor qualification database that you can go out there and look to those that subscribe, and they've already filled out the minimum information. And even though that you've done that, it still gives owners, those that are evaluating the contractor, not only the opportunity, but you should, when we get to some of these other parts, to check the assurances. But there's ways to streamline it where it's not so much of an administrative burden when you're having to fill one of those out. So and you get a lot of again, it's your first snapshot of a company's culture, even though it's written. That's what I think about when you talk about pre-qualification and the minimum requirements.
So on these approaches to pre-qualification, How effective are they in determining if the performance standards will be met?
Again, I'll state where I kind of evolved on it again, and Jerome, you can jump in, is that they, you know, if you take a contractor that has a lot of the information blank, or they may not have the minimum insurance requirements, or they may have had a serious injury or an event that increases the experience modification rate, like Jerome talked about. Well, they may not even be considered for a job, a project, working in a facility, because they did not meet the minimum requirements. I keep using minimum as intentionally, is because if you don't meet that, there's something that's happened in your organization to trigger that event.
Yeah, let's. I think we, just to be clear, we're talking about at this point pre-qualification criteria. That's the minimum criteria that has to be met before you can even be on the bidder's list or bid for the job. And I think we grouped this segment with contractor selection. Then you take all the qualified bidders and you evaluate their technical, their safety performance, their safety programs, their technical capabilities of doing the project, the key personnel that's going to be involved with the project, from the project manager to the superintendent is probably the most key person that's going to be involved with the project. And you may want to even look at past similar projects that they performed during a site visit. So there's a contractor selection process that's evaluated by all disciplines within the organization, not just safety.
Okay, good. Anything else on this first area of pre-qualification and selection?
I think that covers it from a quick snapshot.
We'll be right back after this break. Speer & Lancaster is an expert safety, process safety, and industrial hygiene consulting firm dedicated to helping organizations increase profits using risk management and incident prevention techniques. Speer & Lancaster has over 60 years of combined experience assisting hundreds of national and international organizations in achieving greater profitability by reducing workplace risks. Okay, good. So in our second area of safety and health, contract requirements, what are some of the typical supplemental documents that document needs regarding safety?
We talked about some of the supplementals, like, you know, providing proof of insurance would be one example to help the listeners tie it to pre-qualification. But I want to go another route and provide a couple examples, and pretty important from my view when I was evaluating contractors is, you know, you think of, you've got the language, and then what supplements the contract requirements. One of the first things that I think about is making sure that you have skilled workers to do what's required. So, of course, we're going to explain there's going to be contract language that explains what you have to do, but what does your training program look like? Providing evidence that you have comprehensive training, whether that's confined space entry training, whether that's welding training, whether that's mobile crane operator training. So that's one of the first ones I think of some of the supplementals that goes with it, is making sure that you have competent workers in place. And we'll talk more about that when we get to some of the field verifications. But that's one of them when you start talking about supplemental contract language that I think about.
Right now, when I was for CBI and we were bidding on a job, the salespeople would give me the contract, or at least applicable proportions of safety-related requirements for the job site, to see where do we need clarification on what's required for the job and what's going to cost us more to do this job, what extra is above and beyond. What I find now, what I find by so many standard contracts is that they may reference to comply with all local, federal, state regulations, all OSHA regulations. Well, that's not specific enough. You know, for instance, we were a tank builder at CB&I, so we dealt with a lot of confined spaces, and this was before OSHA's confined space and construction standard was promulgated back in, when was it, 2016, 2015, somewhere around that, around there. The most, the area that we had to be clear on is at what point was this tank that that's under construction is going to be treated as confined space? Because if a host employer is used to general industry standards, which already had a confined space standard, permit required confined space standard, or are they going to treat it as soon as we build the first ring up? So we had to be clear on that. And that was probably the most frequent issue that came up from reading the contracts is how are we treating this work in terms of whether or not it's a confined space and at what point and what's required for that. And the other issue is the matter of fall protection. Some owners may require a more specific fall protection than that's above and beyond what OSHA requires, meaning 100% fall protection where you have to have two lanyards, always have one secured off on a suitable anchorage point. And so that certainly slows down the work. That certainly adds more cost to equipment, things like that. Now, what I'm primarily referring to in this section is establishing specific, as a host employer or general contractor, specific safety and health requirements that's incorporated into the contract documents. Now, I was on the project team back in early 2000s with the American Industrial Hygiene Association Construction Committee. I'm a past chair of that committee, but back in 2005 or 2006, we published a book on safety and health requirements in construction contract documents, specifically what this is referring to, because there is a need on addressing this issue, because most contracts are not specific enough on establishing specific safety and health requirements that they're requiring the contractors to follow. The other, what I consider to be the gold standard in all this is the Army Corps of Engineers Engineering Manual that is incorporated into the contract. And they are probably the gold standard in terms of managing contractor safety and health. I've been on Corps of Engineer jobs. We do some work as a consultant on some of their projects as well. All their safety plans are specified in the contract documents. Sometimes we were involved on a consultant side is to help contractors prepare some of these plans. They have to be submitted to the Corps of Engineers. They review it, come back, whether or not they approve it or not, and so forth. So they, to me, from my experience, they're like the gold standard of how to manage a contractor.
While Jerome's explaining that, Dave, other things I still think about when I reflect 25 plus years on both sides of, simple things in the simple yet important details in the contract language around, what are the, you mentioned fall protection, but the safety and personal protective equipment requirements, are they clear? Are they understood based on the risk for contractor. So, I talked about specifying training requirements, but personal protective equipment and who's responsible for what related to leading safety out in the field, whether that's a supervisor or a safety person, and what type of experience do they need to have to lead safety effectively on the job, on the project, at the facility. Those are some other things that I think about that's important in the contract language to make sure stakeholders are clear.
Excellent. Yeah, and you mentioned the book on contract requirements. I mean, what is the state of contracts today? Are they deficient in this area, or do you think there's more to be done, more to address in terms of training and competency? Where are we today on contract requirements? I mean, I'm assuming it's improved since you wrote the book in 2005, but if you guys could speak to that.
I wouldn't say it really improved all that much, quite honestly. I mean, when it gets to an injury, workplace injury or fatality, and we deal with a lot of multi-employer worksite incidents, especially in our litigation work, cases that we help out with reviewing. And those, we typically do, if it's available, review the contract or subcontract agreement or And It depends on the entity. Sometimes they use the standard AIA form. What is it? American Institute of Architects or something like that, which I believe does not sufficiently address this topic of safety and health requirements. Or they have their own form. And like I said, most of them, the vast majority that I reviewed, even today, just reference, essentially follow state and local and federal OSHA regulations.
Yeah, so the first two that we've talked about, there's the risk of, again, we've talked about the last several minutes of a lot of documentation and a lot of stuff that has to be put together. That stuff, that information, those forms, Dave, are only as good as the eyes, the people, the right experts that need to be looking at it. And that's that important step before things start happening in the field that can get overlooked pretty easy because most of the time, as we talked about, something's not going to happen. And these two steps come to light more after an event has occurred. So that's our push. That's our plea to those listening is if you're not spending time around pre-qualification and looking at those details in the contract, your risk is higher.
Right. Reminds me of Abraham Lincoln, who said if he had 8 hours to chop down a tree, he'd spend 7 hours sharpening his axe and 1 hour chopping.
That's a good analogy. That's it.
Anything else on our second area of safety and health contract requirements?
I think we're good.
On our important topic of improving contractor safety performance, we've covered a lot of great information and heard from our two guests, our two experts with over 60 years of combined experience in dealing with all aspects of contractor safety. So we're going to break it into two parts. We've already covered the pre-qualification and contract requirements. Next, we'll do our third, fourth, and fifth areas of work in progress assurances, owner and general contractor perspectives, and performance evaluations and feedback. Stay with us for this important topic with our experts from Speer and Lancaster.
According to his power that is at work within us,
to him